Welcome to the How to Raise Money podcast for anyone who wants to raise other people's money for a business or property venture. Right now, there has never been more money on the planet, and there has never been more opportunity. This podcast will help you put the two together. So, if you need money for your business or property proposals from banks, lenders, angels, whales, or dragons, this is the podcast for you.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the How to Raise Money podcast. I am Ray McLennan.
And it's with me, Nigel T. Best. Good morning, Ray. How the devil are you today? I mean, it's chucking it down outside. As we probably mentioned on previous podcasts, it's a beautiful game, is football, unless, of course, England are now out, at which point it's a pointless waste of time and we should all get on with lowering the country's debt that we've got because of coronavirus, right? Mm. We've got a conundrum here. Should we all be interested in football, or should we be trying to raise money to help the country out?
Well, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because there's been a lot of printing of money, a lot of debt, billions and billions, and somehow it has to all be paid. And everyone says, well, future generations are going to have to pay for it. I was reading recently about the Lend-Lease scheme from the Second World War, where, incidentally, the final payment was made only in the last couple of years back to America, where America very kindly allowed Britain to borrow millions and millions and millions for the munitions and for food and for all sorts of things. And it was called Lend-Lease, and they had to pay it back. And at the time, they were saying, we are saddling future generations with this massive debt. Now, when you look back on it, the amount of the debt, it's not all that massive, but obviously at the time it was. So when you look at it through the lens of time and you look at it through the lens of inflation, it's not as bad. And I think that will be something similar here. Interest rates will go up if they do go up, and if inflation goes up, then it's going to mean that the debt will not be as harsh. And I think that's the same for individuals, people with mortgages, that sort of thing as well. So it may not be all that much of a challenge. Also, when you consider that the UK government, UK PLC, has never ever defaulted on a debt, it means that for international investors who will be putting money into the UK and buying government bonds, it's a good deal, a sure thing. It's a bit like people that buy stocks and shares. You know, they'll always say to you, like Warren Buffett says, always have shares in Coca-Cola and Procter & Gamble and Marks & Spencers and, you know, the real rock solid ones, because you'll never go wrong. And I think UK PLC falls into that category.
There we go. Well, I mean, Ray, it's one of these things. The Lend-Lease, okay, I'm winding my brain back here. I think that was because America at the time couldn't give us direct support and assistance in the war because America didn't wish to be involved or were kind of semi-prevented. So I think the Lend-Lease was a way around it, wasn't it? They couldn't sell it, but they could lend it to us if we promised to pay back in the future. But now, that's a great example of when you need to raise finance or when you need to get something, think outside the box. If the rules say you can't on a specific route or specific sort of strategy, then think of a different way of doing it. And that was a prime example of getting around it. But interesting what you were talking there about interest rates, inflation, and that sort of thing. Because a lot of people have a concern when they're raising money and they say, gosh, this is an enormous amount. And they look at the total. You should always look in some ways out of curiosity, in other ways, just to give yourself almost a heart attack. Look at the total amount that you're going to repay. And when something has interest attached to it over 25 years, the total amount of repayments on, say, a mortgage can be really quite frightening. However, as you say, when you apply inflation to it and see that inflation is eroding some of that interest and is making it more palatable, more payable, and over time you're hoping that your income will increase above the rate of inflation, and all these other factors that go into it. It's actually a remarkably clever and good way of raising some money, isn't it? To put a bit of debt against the property. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people miss that point. And a lot of people think, oh, no, I don't want to be saddled with this debt. Well, in some ways, if you took interest only loans and you just paid a bit of interest, and at the moment, the interest rates are really very, very low. The inflation has an erosive effect on the actual amount that you're going to have to pay back as a lump sum at the end of it. If you're sort of thinking, I've lost you, Nigel, I'm not too sure what you're talking about. Just put it like this. In 25 years' time, will 60,000 feel like 60,000 does today? And the answer is no. It will hopefully feel like small change, loose change, and you'll be able to do it easily. And that's the effect of time on the value of money. And it's one of these things that, you know, sometimes people don't really think about. And as you say, for the government debt, if you push it out far enough at an interest rate that is palatable enough and good enough, then yeah, add a bit of inflation in there, and suddenly it's not quite so bad.
Well, so, you equate. I mean,
it's weird, isn't it? Economics and
for those of us, value of money. For those of us that can remember buying houses at 20,000 and 30,000 and 40,000 pounds, that sort of thing. I mean, that's a car now, isn't it?
Yeah, and also I remember my dad talking about his mortgage when the mortgage interest rate, I think, briefly went to about 14% or something. Mm-hmm. And I tell you what, if you've got a mortgage now, get a mortgage interest rate calculator and stick in 14%, then pick yourself up off the floor, get yourself a coffee, and just get down on your knees and pray and say, thank you for the fact that it's not 14% at the moment.
Well, we've no interest rate mechanism to pull out from anymore, no gold standard to jump out from. Brexit is done. So what's the next big black swan on the horizon? We've had COVID. Just trying to think, what is the next big black swan that could come on the horizon? Who knows?
I think the salutary lesson from that is there always is one. You know, so you've got to, you know, brace yourself for it. So, and sometimes, Ray, I know you mentioned a few businesses there, and one of them you could say is Marks and Spencer's. And, you know, for many years that was seen as a bedrock. And suddenly now you're looking at it thinking, well, actually, are the foundations quite so good? Because, you know, shopping tastes have changed and everyone's moving away and it's all online, and suddenly they're saddled with properties and high rents and staff costs and all these sort of things. So, you know, things do change. However,
well, that's an interesting one, actually. What, yeah, that triggers a memory. John Lewis, the John Lewis stores. John Lewis have announced that they're going to be building 10,000 houses for rent,
yeah,
in the next few years, and they're going to be using their existing stores.
Yes.
But the way they're going to do it is you're going to get a flat above a Waitrose, and they're going to be providing concierge services, and they're also going to be providing apartments that are furnished with furniture from John Lewis. So it's interesting how they're building that sort of ecosystem where you'll become effectively a John Lewis client for life. Interesting one. Isn't that a sort of subscription based, you know, if you're going to be renting from them, you're renting your property from them, you're renting your furniture from them, you've got Waitrose on the ground floor where you're getting your shopping from. It's not a bad business model if you think about it.
And there's going to be for some people a bit of kudos to say, I live in a John Lewis apartment.
Well, there's the brand as well. That's it.
Yeah, exactly. People are going to say, well, that's obviously, you know, is that an aspirational thing? Who knows, Ray? Who knows? You know, people have often sought out the brand because it gives them some kudos, it gives them some comfort, it gives them a known expectation level of service, comfort, desirability, sell on ability. I mean, I assume that these will be rented only and that they will never be sold off. So, as you say, subscription model, It could well be the way of it.
Can you hear the music?
Just.
This is not an ordinary flat. This is a Marks and Spencer's flat. Could that be the adverts we're going to be seeing over the next few months, few years?
It's interesting. Interesting model. But this is born out of, again, how do you get around the fact that you've got 500,000 square feet of prime real estate in the old days that suddenly isn't quite so prime and isn't quite so beneficial to you? The stores are shrinking. You don't want people in there for those purposes. You don't want the stock in there. You've got yourself an enormous building. Who knows? They might be on a 20-year lease. So you've got 20 years. I think the integrity and the moral positioning of certain companies would say, we will do everything we can to not break the lease and not default. Therefore, we need to find out a better way of using the property. And for many of the...
Sorry, I spoke to an actuary because obviously with the high streets and suffering, etc., pension funds would be suffering because they own a lot of the high street and they own a lot of commercial property. But when I asked them, they said, no, we only hold about 2-3% of our portfolio is commercial property. So most of the big boys, you know, if at 2-3%, that's it. So they're not being hit that badly. And also there are a few out of town shopping centers that they own, and they have their anchor tenant in there. So their anchor tenant could be Marks and Spencers. It could be John Lewis, somebody like that. And if the anchor tenants are looking to move, which they are, then all the rest will be looking to move because the anchor tenants are what drags the people in. So what's the way out for them? Well, developers are now looking at developing these out-of-town shopping centres into residential complexes. So they may have learned the lessons, and a residential complex will no longer just be a block of Soviet-style apartments, but there will be shops there as well. So that's something to look out for.
Yeah, and those anchor tenants, obviously Debenhams was one of the key ones. For many, and that has had knock-on effects. Certainly one near us called the White Rose Shopping Centre, and that had at one point the highest square sales per square foot of the shopping centres, and one of the key anchor tenants was Debenhams in there, and it is changing. It is definitely changing. I think, Ray, what we're going to find is you do your shopping online and you go out for your entertainment, be it a cup of coffee, the cinema, a meal, and those sort of things. And yes, you will probably find the conversion, because a lot of these office and retail parks have very strict covenants that you could not live there. And it's that aspect of it that needs to be reversed. But there are a few, and I have looked at a few, not particularly seriously, but there's been a couple of these sort of smaller office retail units, parks, whatever you want to call them. And a number of them are up for sale, and an awful lot of them are to let. And the combined thing, you know, typically still under one ownership.
Mm-hmm.
And it's as soon as you've got them empty and the to let, then you've got the potential that you're going to be paying the business rates as the landlord.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to do some nifty maneuvering to do deals on those and avoid those, but you can. But for those, that might be the sort of thing that if you're struggling to attract them, and bear in mind with shops, Ray, I'd say it's the same with businesses. You're really not going to want to rent office space in a business park that is 70% empty.
Mm.
It just doesn't feel like a great environment. And similarly with shops, you're not going to want to put your shop into an area that's 70% empty. You've got to have, you know, a bit of a floodgate open and a whole load of people come in. Well, if that office park suddenly has 200 apartments, swap a few out for a couple of smaller shops, you know, a late night store or something, and somewhere to get a coffee, and then, you know, suddenly the business area square footage is smaller, suddenly you don't need so many businesses to fill it, and you've got that mixed development. So maybe that's it, Ray. Maybe we're going to the mixed development. Maybe this is the lend lease that we did with America all those years ago that we've only just paid off.
Well, I can see the day that some of, I mean, there are out of town or edge of town shopping centers, and they have a cinema complex, and they have a, you know, giant bar like a Wetherspoons or something like that, and they have the coffee shop, they have the bookshops, they have the retail premises that people will still go to, which is good. I mean, it always surprises me that, with given the strength of Amazon and all the rest of it, that bookshops are still thriving. You know, people still want to go and browse. People still like the smell of books. They like to pick them up, and the thud factor. I mean, there was a few years back, everyone was saying a Kindle was going to take over and there were going to be no more books anymore. And then once people had the Kindle, used it a few times, everyone reverted back to books again, which is interesting. So I can see those retail parks having more residential units in them, maybe above the shops that were there, and maybe because of permitted development, they can add on a couple of extra floors. So you'll be living in a village which has a cinema nearby. And bear in mind, you're not going to need to drive to it. You don't need to drive to the cinema. You won't need to drive to the restaurant, to the pub, to the bookshop. They're all there. They're all within strolling distance of where you'll live. I can see that as being a suitable template for the near future.
Well, on that, couple of things. On the, you know, when somebody says, oh, it's going to kill this off, the Kindle's going to kill it off, I think what they failed to realize was it rekindled the desire for people to read books. So what you found was, okay, yeah, a lot of people swapped out of hardback and paperback, but then people who weren't reading, because they couldn't be bothered to carry a book around, wanted to do it because they couldn't get the app on their phone. So what you find is the actual consumption of books has probably increased, and the actual hard physical version has probably held its own in that time. Going back to the sort of scenario of a mixed use, so it used to be an office development. You could see it was always empty for the last 5 years, and suddenly you put a bit of life back into it. Who are the sort of people that want to potentially just stay in something convenient? You can park outside. There's a few facilities nearby, but it gives them access to all sorts of other places. Well, it's the people who are wanting a very short term or serviced accommodation. So they are looking at those, and it could be younger people typically who might want to work somewhere for a year or be somewhere for a year or two. This is the more transient, higher churn rate of people that have been there. So whether it's 2 nights, 2 weeks, 2 months, 2 years, it's going to attract that sort of customer base. And that's going to be very different to your leafy suburb of semis with a garage and a nice garden, where the turnover there is probably every 10 years for the houses on average. So you've got to look at this and think, okay, is there an opportunity for this? And I'm sure in terms of raising the finance for it, I'm sure there's an opportunity with the owner of those particular sort of slightly tired industrial estate type office block estate type things, because, you know, it's going to be a changing landscape, and this might be the opportunity to get in, have a look at them, see what you think.
Well, in terms of that, co-living, there's been an increase in a demand for co-living now, where we were discussing building some apartments, and the architect said, you know, rather than build 39, 49 singular apartments, could you include within them some HMOs, some mini HMOs? Because people would like to live in community. Even, you know, I said, well, it is a community. There's a one bedroom flat. And they said, no, they want to live in a closer community. So to be in a building with 4 or 5 others and common shared kitchen, that sort of thing. So they have their own space, but then they also have a community space. And that is being encouraged actively by architects, apparently driven by demand. So we're now rethinking a couple of the sites that we're looking at to, instead of just putting in 49 apartments, we'll be putting in, you know, 21 bedrooms, and then maybe 15 two bedrooms, and then a few that are effectively mini HMOs.
Interesting. I mean, it goes back to the old adage of don't put all your eggs in one basket. you know, spread the risk. And the way that, if you do that, the way that you can design that is to easily, if one is working, one isn't, then if that architect's, you know, worth his salt, then he will be saying, okay, if this changes in the next 5 years, we can just simply move this wall, do that, change that. And, you know, the planning permission should be relatively straightforward, and the change, you know, the build cost, the alteration cost would be minimal. So that's what you're really wanting, is design a building that can flex with the trends of the market.
Indeed. Indeed. Well, we're doing that already, because one of the buildings we were looking at was going to be a semi-medical facility. And that has changed to apartments. It was a semi-medical facility that had the ability built in that if the market changed, it could be made into residential units. So modular construction, it's the party walls and various other things that are the issue, but it was all built in.
There you go. Ahead of the curve.
Yeah. So how do you raise money for things like that? Well, there's another challenge now that comes, because money guys, lenders, like certainty. They like things they can understand. Now, we have already had a number of run-ins with lenders who don't understand serviced accommodation. They just don't get it. You know, what is it? Is it a hotel? Is it is it rental? What is it? And they just like it when you say, actually, it's a hotel. Ah, right, I get my head around that. Or it's residential units that are being rented out. So they're being rented out by the day. You know, that then creates another level of suspicion. But it's actually market changing, and they need to get their head around the fact that it's still a building. It's an income producing asset. Whether it produces income on a daily, weekly, monthly or yearly basis should be irrelevant, really. But when it comes to raising money, those, I suppose, innovations, can we call them innovations, where people have a business park and there's going to be residential above it, will lenders go for it when it comes to raising money? If there's any lenders listening, I'd like them to get in touch, tell us what they think. I am going to make a note to contact a few of them this week and find out what they think of those kind of things and see where their heart and head lies.
Yeah, it'd be also interesting to get the what they call non-standard construction. The views on that, because obviously the market is moving very quickly to different build types, building in factories, building in warehouses, building undercover. You avoid all the weather related issues. You ship the stuff out and you assemble it on site, having done the groundworks. Be interesting to get their view on that, because it's typically been awkward. Because if it wasn't bricks or standard construction, their models of how long are these things going to last, and, you know, will they blow over in a mild breeze, those sort of things, cause problems. So, Ray, I think that would be really useful to get that feedback for the listeners who may be thinking, I think I might build something with some modular SIP panels with spruce and larch on the outside and lamb's wool on the inside with a bit of hay bale for insulation, and let's find out what the take is on it, because all these things we're gonna have to be a little bit more adaptive, a little bit more flexible in order to do it. And typically what you find is if someone jumps on the bandwagon and realizes it's good when it comes to lending money, it doesn't take long before the big boys suddenly relax and go, oh, okay, hang on. Well, we're going to do that too, because otherwise we're going to lose our entire business here. And that's, you know, we've spoken about challenger banks, making the traditional high street banks, you know, act in ways that they probably wouldn't have dreamt of doing a few years ago. And maybe that's going to happen here when the lenders get out. Those challenger lenders on that may well do that, you know, come into these different type of strategy models. And they may be thinking, there's no point looking beyond 5 years on the time horizon, you know, because the market's going to move again in 5 years. So what I want to know is how's your building going to flex? What are your, as we always say, your exits further down the line? So it might be a very interesting conversation. Stay tuned, folks, for the feedback. And prepare yourself to be hugely underwhelmed. Yeah, we built that up, didn't we? And they're going to come back and go, we don't know.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I've made a note to start asking today.
Very good.
Start asking from today. All right. Good.
Excellent.
That's been good. So.
All right. Yeah, Ray, just before we go, don't forget, folks, go to the website, www.htrmoney.co.uk. We're building up a repository of free help guides, templates, whatever they might be. So we've spoken about estate planning or protecting your wealth. That's going to be available very soon, or hopefully by the time this comes out, will be available. We've also got things on your perfect pitch template. So again, useful guides, getting some great feedback from that. And yes, folks, we are building out some more in-depth where we can go deep dive and get in there and help you with bigger parts of the whole process of how to raise money in the form of some training. We've got a beta user at the moment going through. It's given us some great feedback. Thank you. I'm going to give you a shout out, Jane. Thank you very much, Jane. Had a great chat with her the other day and she gave some great feedback. So there we go. There's plenty coming on that website. And if you want to get in touch with us, hello@htrmoney.co.uk. Okay, Ray, I'm going to see you next time.
Okay. Thank you, Nigel. I've been Ray McLennan.
I'm still Nigel T-Best. Bye for now.
Bye for now.
Thank you for listening to the How to Raise Money podcast. It's made for people who want to raise money as debt or investment equity for their business or property proposal or empire. The website has all the useful links and underlying research, and you can get downloads of the checklists and other useful information. See you next time, where we can show you how to raise money. There is abundance. There is money enough for everyone on the planet. The question is, who has yours?